So a couple things. First, if you are getting CEUs, you need to sign in today, take your certificate, and also fill out an anonymous evaluation, which is all sitting there. Secondly, at the end of the class today, we'll have a little bit of an art fair. We've got stuff around the room that you might want to look at. And I think, because I'm seeing Rich sitting back there, I think I'll put on a soundtrack while we're doing that.
So I got to remember to do that.
Let's get this.
Where is it? Hang on. Oh, I'll find it.
I think I'll find it anyway.
Hey. Yeah, there it is. Okay.
All right. Okay, so. Yes, Len.
Abraham's back.
Abraham's back, yes. Yeah.
Thank you for missing me.
All right. So, next term. You heard this twice already. Consciousness class starts January 15th, goes four sessions. Same time, same place, different subject. Okay. Well, related subject. So, consciousness class in this room starting January 15th.
It's $33, right?
What? It's 36 bucks, yeah.
Because it's only a 4-week class. Yeah,
exactly. Yes, 4-week class. And then Adventures in Consciousness is a one-time, 3-hour class in room 31 where we actually either sit in a comfortable chair or preferably lie on the floor and go into a trance and experience aspects of our consciousness.
Do you have a date for that?
We've done that.
So I said you have a date for that?
Yeah, oh, that's February 20th. February 20th. And that's limited to 50 people, so you might want to sign up in advance for that.
We have to wait
until
the class registers, don't we?
Yes, you have to wait till registration starts.
When does it start?
I have no idea. Yeah.
You don't do that, right?
I don't do it, right. I just sneak in. Okay. We have a lot to do today, and hopefully it will be worth doing. So let's start by sitting. I want to say just a few words before we sit. First of all, in this 10-minute period, do anything that's called you to do in terms of working on yourself and making spiritual progress. Joe Campbell said, I can't imagine not taking some time every day to do something like this. Given the kind of lifestyle we have. I think that's true. You ought to do something, whatever it is that calls you, whether it's yoga or doing mindfulness or walking in nature or whatever, to get a sense of how you are, who you are, and what you value. I think that's kind of a necessary readjustment of all the pressures on us that happen. So, if you're doing mindfulness, what I want to remind you of is mindfulness is not getting away from stuff. Rather, it's exactly opposite. It's opening up to whatever your experience is. You open up to it. You approach it. But you don't, when you open up to what you're experiencing, you don't get absorbed by one particular thing or another. What you do is you open up beyond any individual thing. You create space. Spaciousness, I think, is the kind of most, or one of the most, the best metaphors for mindfulness. You just open up beyond any particular experience so that you become the space in which all experiences can happen. And you see all experiences as simply constellations of consciousness moving through this universe of consciousness that you are. So you're just increasingly opening and opening and opening and opening to whatever is. and you acknowledge everything that is, but you don't become absorbed or narrowed by anything. You just keep opening further and further. So if there's a difficulty that you find in body, heart, or mind, you absolutely experience it, but you open beyond it so that it has space. All difficulties are contractions. So if you keep creating space, then these contractions in their time open into a more expansive state. That's the healing process. Okay, so having said that, let's sit. Well, and how do you do this? You do this by finding your breathing, just resting your awareness on your breathing, and just allowing your mind, your heart, your body to open ever more completely. I will ring the bell in 10 minutes. I hope and expect we'll have a little time to talk about what I'm going to talk about now, and also the mission statement and driving considerably. I think we'll have a little time to talk about those in a little while. But I want to talk to you first, just in case we don't have enough time to do that. I want this lecture to be have enough time to do it. What I want to do is, as promised in the course description, I want to put together East and West and talk about happiness in kind of the broadest sense. So, let's go to work. Oh, and then after we do these things, you get to meet Robert Wright. Some of you have already seen that video. It's worth seeing again. The rest of you, you'll see what Marty was talking about in chapter 14 and why what Wright said is world-changing. It's world-changing and incredibly positive. Or credibly positive, then. Okay, so happiness. All right. I made notes, and I might have to refer to them, but maybe not. So let's start with the self. The less happy people are, the more unhappy people are, generally the more self-focused they are, the more worried about themselves and attentive to themselves they are. Some psychotic people, they don't have any other reality but the reality that's going on inside them. Neurotic people walk around worried about everything. Am I doing, you know, it's like walking around with rear view mirrors on. You're always kind of thinking about, did I say the right thing? Did I do the right thing? Anxiety is, will I be okay in this situation? You know, depression is, oh God, I feel so bad. You know, the world is terrible, blah, blah. So the difficulties seem to be about too much self. Many of you know that in depression, there's a problem with rumination. People just kind of think about what's wrong all the time. Oh, by the way, in case we don't get to this, those of you who read chapter 12, in all that stuff about child rearing, there was one incredibly important fact about depression. Anybody remember what that fact was about the ratio of positive to negative thoughts in depressed people versus non-depressed people? For two gold stars, anybody get that?
But I'm depressed.
Greg Garamone and Robert Schwartz. In depressed people, they did a meta-analysis of, I think, 28 studies. And in depressed people, there are about as many negative as positive thoughts, about 1-to-1 ratio. In non-depressed people, there are about twice as many positive as negative thoughts. And if you can raise, by cognitive therapy, the ratio from 1-to-1 to 2-to-1 positive to negative, you raise you lift the depression. There was some good stuff away in that chapter, those of you who did the assigned reading. I'm presaging what Robert Wright is going to say about the assigned reading that you didn't do. Anyway, back to the self. The problem is too much self in people that are not okay. Too much self-focus. It's not that you don't want self-focus, it's that you don't want exclusive self-focus. So what has to happen for that process of freeing oneself from the self to happen is the self has to be put together in a healthy way. Typically, when you look at a person who is kind of self-obsessed, they're two things. You're seeing two things. First, you're seeing that they don't have an accurate picture of themselves. They're not in touch with who they actually are. They're blinded by who they should be and who they're afraid they are. And secondly, the aspects of self are conflicted. They're not integrated. They war with one another. So a fragmented, untrue sense of self has to morph into, or has to grow into, a unified, accurate sense of self.
Congruent?
What?
Congruent?
Yeah, you could say congruent, okay. So how do you do that? How do you go from untrue sense of self? Oh, remember what Soren Kierkegaard said. He said the common despair is to not choose to be who one is, and the deepest despair is to choose to be other than who one is. Okay. So the idea is you either don't accept yourself fully, or you put on a front of you adopt a phony self because that's what is you feel is okay. So how do you get from this not okay sense of self to okay sense of self? You have to accept what is. It's all about acceptance. You have to, Eckhart Tolle would call it surrender. You have to kind of surrender to the actual situation that you find in your inspection of yourself. You have to say, you know, I'm not exactly perfect in this way, in this way, in this way, in this way. And so you take all that unconscious shadow material that you put it away because it was not acceptable, and you realize that it is. So you're gonna have to deal with it as it is. Okay? And when you do that, you bring things into consciousness, and then they can find their way into an organic, healthy pattern. Okay? By denying aspects of yourself, you can't bring yourself to be authentic.
Tolle also said about aligning the outer purpose with the inner purpose. And the inner purpose being awareness, you know, what we've been working on.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. Okay, so let's say that you go, so how do you do this? I'm going to make three arrows to how you can have a healthier sense of self. One arrow is psychotherapy. I'll make that arrow right now. But the goal isn't to have a healthy sense of self and to stay stuck in the self. That would by itself be not healthy. The goal is to get out of the self. So that the self-definition, it's not that you don't have a self, but the self-definition broadens to include two aspects, something interior to the self and the world exterior to the self. So the sense of self, as it gets healthier, opens. So, the two directions that you can go from self, that you need to grow from self, or that you need to expand the self-definition to include, are essence, something more essentially who you are, more central, more fundamental, more than your usual sense of self, and other people, and the activities of living. So you need to go interior to yourself and you need to go exterior to yourself. Okay. So how do you do that? Mindfulness will do two things. First, it will give you a more accurate view of yourself because you're opening to what is, and out come the demons that you have stuck away and the problems that, you know, you get a clearer sense of yourself. And if you accept what you find, these aspects of yourself, you know, by non-acceptance, You got to be fragmented because you weren't given unconditional love. You were given conditional love. No, that's not good. We don't want to see that again, you know, so you put it away. You know, every kids are born with all the equipment they need to succeed in life, and then we dismantle half their equipment because we don't like it. It's not polite. It's not instead of showing them how to use everything that they have that they were born with, we tell them to get rid of the stuff that isn't socially acceptable in the way that it initially arises. For example, we say don't get angry instead of showing kids what anger is good for and how anger can be evolved into determination and courage and will. And when you don't have anger, you don't have determination, courage, or will, you know. If you're mindful, all these disowned aspects of self are going to rise into awareness and then eventually are going to find a healthy way to be integrated into the personality. So mindfulness definitely helps you become a healthier person. But it also does something else, which you well know, which is you realize that the self that you thought you were is, you know, on the other side there, is not the self that you, is not who you really are. You're a deeper creature than your thoughts, feelings, and sensations. So mindfulness, at the same time as it helps you integrate yourself, unify yourself, feel better about yourself, understand yourself better, be truer to yourself, also takes you to a deeper sense of who you are, a broader sense of who you are. Right? So it brings you out of yourself interiorly to something more fundamental. Okay. How do you get out in the other direction? Positive psychology does two things. First, it helps you become a healthier self. Remember, the whole first part of the book is about changing your feelings about the past so you feel better about yourself vis-a-vis the past, changing your feelings about the future in terms of disputing negative expectations so you feel better about yourself at present and looking toward the future, and it shows you how to be happier in the present by doing things like savoring positive experiences. The first part of the book is all about building self, and especially it helps you to identify your strengths and then build your sense of self around those strengths. So positive psychology is very focused with the signature strengths stuff on building a healthy sense of self. But positive psychology in the second part of the book says go out of yourself, engage in life. The extreme of engagement, of course, is flow. We'll put that out there. But engage in life. Connect with other people. Connect with activities that call your signature strengths to be used in those activities. So in the second part, especially connect with things that are meaningful outside yourself. So positive psychology first strengthens your sense of self and then extends your sense of self to greater engagement. Remember what Marty Seligman says is authentic happiness is this. Okay, it involves here. So what are the three senses of happiness that we have learned about? First, the happiness that you get from enjoying yourself, having pleasure, is the sense of happiness that most people think about happiness being. So this is pleasure. Okay. When you ask people what's happiness, they say, "Oh, it's smiley face. It's good feelings." That's the sense of self that comes primarily from that sense of happiness that comes primarily from self-focus. That's not wrong, but what Marty says is that's not authentic happiness. That's not deepest happiness. The deepest kind of happiness, he says, is the happiness that comes from forgetting yourself in the relationship with other people and with activities that involve you completely. So this would be authentic happiness. Let me see if I put another word for that. Yes, this would be gratification. He says gratification is deeper, more lastingly satisfying than pleasure. Pleasure, you know, pleasure goes, comes and goes really easily. Gratification stays. So this is the deeper form of happiness, gratification. I'm just reiterating what we've been learning, right? I'm just putting it all together. Question is there a third kind of happiness? And Anid, who isn't here today, first mentioned this to me, and she's right. People who experience, who come from here, talk about a different kind of happiness than pleasure or even gratification. They talk about a kind of happiness that is different ways to look at it, bliss, joy, peace, serenity. There's some kind of unshakable, ultimate happiness that people at least touch when they're in this state a lot. So let's call that kind of happiness, let's just call it a deeper kind of happiness, okay? And you define it for yourself as you experience it. This is not talked about by positive psychology. It is talked about by spiritual practice. So this is spiritual kind of fulfillment. So this kind of puts together everything that we've learned in terms of the kinds of happiness that are available and how you get those kinds of happiness and how East and West blend together to grow the sense of self. Okay? First to make the sense of self stronger and then to extend the sense of self so that it becomes more and more unified with what's around it and within it. So comments or questions? Abraham.
When you forget yourself dealing with other people in order to establish positive psychology, don't the other people take advantage of you?
If they do, then you will come back into yourself and protect yourself. Okay, the idea, you know,
Forgetting yourself and remembering yourself.
You expand and contract as you need. Okay. The idea is you open to life, to other people, to situations as fully as you can, and then if it becomes obvious that there's it's not appropriate, then you close up to defend yourself. But most of us have learned to stay pretty close and walk into situations with a lot of defense on. And then we don't fully get the satisfaction of what's offered to us because we have learned to stay close to protect ourselves. So the idea is you have to open, walk into situations, and most situations will be fulfilling. The ones that aren't, it's chronic closure. Opening and closing is healthy. Chronic closure is always unhealthy. Right? So the point is, most of us walk around with armor on. You can't walk around very well with armor on in the world, and you don't have very good comments when you've got a suit of armor. I saw, this is kind of beside the point, but I saw the Bar Association, American Bar Association Journal for this past month, and it had a picture of a guy in a suit of armor, and it said something about lawyers, da-da-da-da-da-da, but I thought the picture was worth a million words. Here's this guy, this lawyer, and he's wearing a suit of armor on the front cover. Marty wasn't entirely wrong when he talked about the law. all right, so any other questions or comments about this? Okay, Peg.
When I think about that open and close, I've worked really hard through mindfulness to get very clear on my boundaries,
yeah,
and what my limitations are, given, you know, I don't see out this eye. I mean, and people, you know, so basically, a question that pops up for me is, Peg, what is your boundary? and being clear is me being myself, being open, being all of that, is somebody stepping over that boundary.
Boundaries are important. If you don't have any boundaries, you get run over by the world. And if you have too much boundary, there's no world. The idea is to have flexible boundaries, you know, to open completely when it's appropriate, to close completely when it's appropriate, but to know where your boundary is. But the idea, as your sense of self becomes enlarged, okay, as your boundary becomes further out from yourself in general, you have a larger sense of life, and you include more of life in yourself. But of course you have to have boundaries. You know, you can't be naive, you know, and you can't be hurt.
And you recognize weather.
Yeah, right, and where the weather's coming from.
Yeah.
Okay, so other comments about this. It's so, you know, this is nothing you don't know. I mean, it's just putting it all together in a kind of convenient way. Michael.
It's important to remember that happiness is a process and not an end goal or state that, okay, I've got it, I'm happy, now I've got that, next.
It's only by the unification, the experiencing of pleasure in the moment and the unification in both senses that happiness becomes available. But it's always, yeah, it's dynamic process. There's no way to fix happiness because everything is moving. Anything else you want to say about this before we leave this? Clear?
Okay, now you sort of like moving from self.
I like so deeper than mine.
From self to
no self, and then back.
Well, you know, I don't like no self very much. It always can seem negative to me. I think that's it's a bad translation. I think what you're moving from is a self that is separate. You know, the people that are in the worst shape feel the most isolated, the most separate. The people that are the happiest seem to be the people who feel the most connected, the most unified. The people that are really spiritually, connected feel that it's all one thing. It's all one being. It's all one spirit. So, depending on the situation, you broaden the sense of self. Maslow, before he knew any about it, he knew nothing about any of this stuff. What he said is self-actualizing people aren't self-focused, they're problem-focused. That is, they know they're okay, they don't worry about themselves, they're looking at, their energy is going out from them, their energy is not back in them. So it's not no self, it's an expanded sense of self. Self isn't a skin-encapsulated ego, right? Like, who's that guy, what's his name? The first of us, I just forget his name right now. The guy that called himself a spiritual entertainer. I'll remember it, well, you'll all remember him. You know, he's the first guy to teach us. He's the English guy. Died of alcoholism. Alan Watts, yeah, Alan, thank you. Alan Watts, just couldn't, you know, it's an altered state to be in front of people, you kind of can't remember anything. So, Alan Watts said, you have to go from being a skin-encapsulated ego to something larger than that. So I think that it's not no self, I think that it's self, the boundary of self opens so that you don't see who you are as essentially separate, but essentially connected and unified. And I think, you know, while I'm talking about it, I think kind of that's the way to look at the end of our life, is if you're living right, you went from an infant, you know, only self, and you grew and you started to branch out more and include more love and connection in your life, and as you grow older, you unify with larger causes and larger problems in the world and larger groups of people. And finally, you just are too big for your body. And you go back to the unity that you came from. You know, it's like this. Right? You come back and then you go like that. So that's kind of the way I look at it is, you know, kind of when I go, what goes is my body, but I'm just it's all one thing. I'm just kind of one, I'm like one, the metaphor I use is, well, I'll use a different metaphor. From the point of view of the leaf, when the leaf dies, that's the end of the deal. The leaf falls off the tree. But you and I know from stepping back that the life isn't in the leaf, the life is in the tree, right? And when the tree dies, from the tree's point of view, oh, that's tragedy, that's all there is. But if we step back even further, we see it's the forest, not the one tree. The life is in the forest. And if we step back even further, we see it's not the forest, it's the whole ecosystem. So the point is, as you grow and grow and grow, you see that it's all the same thing, and the world ain't going to end when I'm not here. You know, and if the world ends, there's a lot of worlds, you know. Anyway, so I think the sense of self, it's not no self. It's the self being larger and larger and larger, so that you don't walk around in your little self anymore. You walk around in a larger sense of life. Mike?
What helps me is embracing the Hindu idea of namaste, where we honor the love and light and truth that's in us, that is in everyone, and take it to a very divine level. That when we recognize that, then we're all one.
Yeah, there's you look at the essence, and there's one essence, which, you know, that's that's a kind of an advanced question for, or an advanced idea for mindfulness, which is, who are you? You know, when does you come into being when you're sitting being mindful? Is if there is no thought, okay, is there any you? And Eckhart Tolle would say, the pain body comes into existence with thought, right? Which is true. So, you know, the question is, who are you really? You figure that out, okay? Or you experience that. But I think you'll find that you doesn't arise until the usual patterns of thinking arise. Robert.
My understanding is that the advance that the Buddha made over Hinduism was saying there is no essence to anything, including you. How do you deal with that?
That was the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. There were three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, and the third turning was Buddha nature. So the later Buddhist thinkers said, you're not there, everything is impermanent. So the first turning of the wheel of Dharma was, how do you escape from suffering? By not identifying with this stuff. Second turning of the wheel of Dharma was, you know, everything's impermanent and there's really no self. But the third turning of the wheel of Dharma is, there is something. And we call that Buddha nature. So there is some essence, it's just not a personal essence. So that's Buddhist thought in a nutshell. And I like it. It's a little too nihilistic to have everything impermanent and nothing and no sense of self. It's much nicer to feel that there's something undergirding that understanding. But if you don't like that, the science way to do this is the first thing that became alive, you know, maybe it became alive, maybe there were a lot of different places in the world where organic molecules morphed into what we would now call life. But the point is, I don't look at each of us as a separate life. I look at each of us as a separate attempt by that activity of the universe to continue. That is, there's one life which expresses itself in all these different ways, because the life that arose from non-life wants to continue to exist. So my read is, essentially what I am is life Spencing. And you're life Roberting, you know, but it's not. When I go, it's not going to be the end of life, because essentially that's what's happening here. We're just different expressions of that activity of the universe.
We're stewing, you're
spins
like.
All right, and one more, and then we gotta move, okay? Let's see, two more people. Okay, so first we're gonna go to Len, then we're gonna go to Carl. Loud, yell.
Spence, in the book, Marty, who is a very good philosopher, was wise enough to weave in the importance of virtue in happiness, particularly in his discussions of eudaimonia. Can you weave that thread into what you've done up there?
Yeah, you can, you know, happiness comes from using the best of yourself in ways that support life. Okay, so the problem, the reason that positive psychologists are so concerned with virtue, okay, and with values, is because signature strengths can be used for good or bad ends. Somebody can have a signature strength and they can rip off other people or they can hurt other people using their strengths. You know? So the idea is we have to have a positive direction. What Aristotle said is you're not going to be happy unless you use the best of yourself in the service of what is best. And that's how that falls in the direction that we have to, when we go out here, we have to go in an affirmative direction if we're going to be happy. Carl.
I've been looking at life through the microscope of cell biology for a while, and your ruminations on the role of the individual in society sort of triggered my thoughts about each of ourselves has this potential to fulfill many different roles, but it fulfills a particular role, particularly in our brain. The individual neurons exist and perform their activities for us through connectedness. And it sort of relates to this connectedness in society that contributes to our happiness, that any one cell comes and goes, but the connected network and the flow of information through these elements, these cell elements, is the essence of the human being. And it's bigger than any one cell, but each one is important, and each one is individualized in its strengths and its connections, and has a finite life, but the larger network and the information that flows through it remains constant, or it remains continuous. It exists forever. And our cell lines are immortal. Since we've survived billions of years. So
what Carl's saying is if you look little, you find out that you're 100 billion different living things all put together, okay? You're the whole forest, so there's a lot of trees in there. And if you look at your brain, each of those neurons is a living thing, but they work, the 100 billion, the 86 billion of them work together to create this larger being, each of us being a neuron in the 7 billion human being, you know. But as Carl said, you know, what survives is the pattern, not the individual units in the pattern. You know, you make new liver, new heart, new everything all the time, but the pattern remains.
In harmony.
What?
Everything, like heart, is completely different than stomach or muscles, but in our bodies, all work in harmony.
But they all work in harmony, yeah, for the good of the organism, which works for the good of something larger. Okay, I need to shift gears, because I have to introduce what Robert Wright is going to talk to us about. First of all, just a word about Marty's theology, okay? Those of you who read chapter 14, I'm sure you had varying opinions about Marty's theology.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah, you're welcome. What he's saying, okay, what Marty is saying, is, which you may or may not agree with, I guess I got to say a bunch of words about this. Okay, what Marty's saying that you may or may not agree with is, he can't imagine, he's a science guy, he can't imagine anything transcendent. But what he says is the God that people think is out there, from his point of view, is a projection of where evolution is going. It's a projection of the best in us. We take a sense of the perfection that we're moving toward, and we project it out there as something out there when it's actually pregnant in us. And where we're going is to those qualities that we now ascribe to a transcendent being. So that's a kind of a nice science-y way to kind of feel okay about the fact that there actually is a moral direction to evolution, which is what Bob Wright's going to talk about. However, I got to say this, okay? Science only, you know, remember that story about the guy that the Sufi story about the guy that loses his keys in the dark and he's looking for them under a street lamp and somebody comes along, a policeman comes along and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm looking for my keys." And the policeman gets down on his hands and knees and they're both looking for the keys. The policeman said, "Are you sure you lost your keys here?" And Nasruddin says, "No, I think I lost them over there." "Well, why are you looking here?" "Because there's more light here." So it's kind of like, it's a Sufi story. It's about, anyway. So science only looks at what it looks like. And science is all about your senses and the world available to your senses and the instruments that increase the power of your senses. So science says what's real is what is sensorily available. What you can measure, what you can touch, what you can smell, and when you can use good instruments, you can make better, you know, you can smell better, you can touch better, you can look better. But it's all about the world of the senses. That doesn't say anything about the possibility that there's a whole other level of reality which creates or includes sensory reality. Science can't see that, so it says it's not there. But science shouldn't say it's not there. Science should say, as far as we can see, it's not there. On the sensory level, we can look out billions of light years and we don't see any heaven. You know? But that's because you're looking on the sensory level. There could be a level of reality that brings into being the sensory level. Or influences at every point the sensory level. Does that make sense to people? Science has nothing to say about whether there's a transcendent level or not. It only says we can't see it from where we're looking. So to me, it's a very open question. You know, I haven't had a mystical experience. People who have mystical experience say, "Oh, duh, now I see there's a whole other level that I didn't know was there before that supports this level or brings into being this level." Marty can't see that. He's never had a mystical experience, so he should be saying, "I don't know." You know, maybe all these people aren't fools all around the world. Maybe they've had some experiences that I just haven't had yet. Anyway, that makes sense, right?
Yes.
Because I think that's the way to heal these debates between science and religion. It's just, you know, if one person's talking about over there and one person's talking about over there, why are they arguing about what's over there or over there instead of saying there are two possibilities here, you know? Okay, so now, Marty. The reason that I think this is the most important TED Talk ever and maybe the most important talk I've ever heard ever is because always when people say, "What's going to prevent the world from going to hell," which it obviously is, okay? What's going to do that is people are going to have to evolve. People are going to have to be better or else the world is going down, you know? Because people are too self-focused and they're too tribal and, you know, they can get more power, but they don't get more enlightenment. They're better able to kill themselves and take advantage of one another, you know? So that's the usual thing, but the problem is, as those of you who are therapists know, change is very, very hard. People don't change so radically or so easily or so well, you know? So even though I hope Barbara's right, Barbara Marx Hubbard is right, and we're going through an evolutionary crisis and it's going to seed change, which it will. I mean, I think that the world is changing for sure and people are changing, but I don't want to pin my hopes for humanity on the fact that everybody's going to suddenly wear a halo. You know, I think that's a bad bet. I think our power to destroy one another is outpacing our power to do well by one another. But Robert Wright's vision is profoundly positive and doesn't rest on humanity changing. What it rests on is self-interest. On humanity, what he's saying is the world is going to be saved, and it's going to be saved not because we're going to be better, but because we're going to be who we are, because it's to our advantage to save the world. So, with no further preamble, but with some discussion afterward, I want you to hear this talk by Robert Wright that blew Marty away and that should blow everybody away in a positive direction. Quarters of a million views, it should have more views than any other TED Talk ever. This guy, okay, as he's going to tell you, this is the most unlikely optimist you are ever going to meet. He's Princeton educated and, well, you'll see. If you can believe anybody with optimism, you're going to believe this guy. So here we go.
I've got nearly 18 minutes to convince you that history has a direction, an arrow, that in some fundamental sense it's good, that the arrow points to something positive. Now, when the TED people first approached me about giving this upbeat talk, That was before the cartoon of Muhammad had triggered global rioting. It was before the avian flu had reached Europe. It was before Hamas had won the Palestinian election, eliciting various countermeasures by Israel. And to be honest, if I had known, when I was asked to give this upbeat talk, that even as I was giving the upbeat talk, the apocalypse would be unfolding. I might have said, is it okay if I talk about something else? But I didn't. Okay, so we're here. I'll do what I can. I gotta warn you. The sense in which my worldview is upbeat has always been kind of subtle, sometimes even elusive. The sense in which I can be uplifting and inspiring, I mean, there's always been a kind of a certain grim dimension to the way I try to uplift. So if grim inspiration is not a contradiction in terms, that is, I'm afraid, the most you can hope for, okay, today. That's if I succeed. I'll see what I can do, okay? Now, in one sense, the claim that history has a direction is not that controversial. If you're just talking about social structure, okay, clearly that's gotten more complex over the last 10,000 years. It's reached higher and higher levels. And in fact, that's actually sustaining a long-standing trend that predates human beings, okay, that biological evolution was doing for us. Because what happened in the beginning, this stuff encases itself in a cell. Then cells start hanging out together in societies. Eventually, they get so close they form multicellular organisms. Then you get complex multicellular organisms. They form societies. But then at some point, one of these multicellular organisms does something completely amazing with this stuff, which is it launches a whole second kind of evolution, cultural evolution. And amazingly, that evolution sustains the trajectory that biological evolution had established toward greater complexity. Okay? By cultural evolution, we mean the evolution of ideas. A lot of you have heard the term memes. The evolution of technologies I pay a lot of attention to. So, you know, one of the first things you got was little hand axe. Generations go by, somebody says, hey, why don't we put it on a stick? Just absolutely delights the little ones. And the next best thing to a video game. Advancing is impressive. The technological evolution is progressive. So another 10, 20,000 years, and normally this technology takes you here. Impressive. And the rate of technological evolution speeds up. So a mere quarter of a century after this, you get this. Okay? And this. I'm sorry. But I wanted to find a way to transition back to this idea of the unfolding apocalypse, and I thought that might be good. Okay, so what threatens to happen with this unfolding apocalypse is the collapse of global social organization. Now, personally, remind you how much work it took to get us where we are, to be on the brink of true global social organization. Originally, you had the most complex society, hunter-gatherer village. That's Stone Age is the remnant of a chiefdom, which is what you get with the invention of agriculture, multi-village polity, with centralized rule. With the invention of writing, you start getting cities. This is blurry. I kind of like that because it makes it look like a one-celled organism and reminds you how many levels organic organization has already moved through to get to this point. And then you get to empires. I want to stress, social organization can transcend political bounds. This is the Silk Road connecting the Chinese Empire and the Roman Empire, okay? So you had social complexity spanning the whole continent, even if no polity did similarly. Today you've got nation states. Point is, there's obviously collaboration and organization going on beyond national bounds. This is actually just a picture of the Earth at night. Now I'm just putting it up because I think it's pretty. Does kind of convey the sense that this is an integrated system. Okay, now I explain this growth of complexity by reference to something called non-zero sumness. Assuming that a few of you did not do the assigned reading, very quickly, the key idea is this distinction between zero-sum games in which correlations are inverse, okay, always a winner and a loser, non-zero-sum games in which correlations can be positive, okay? So like in tennis, usually it's win-lose, it always adds up to zero-zero-sum, but if you're playing doubles, the person on your side of the net, they're in the same boat as you, so you're playing a non-zero-sum game with them, it's either for the better or for the worse, okay? A lot of forms of non-zero-sum behavior in the realm of economics and so on in everyday life. Often leads to cooperation. The argument I make is basically that, well, non-zero-sum games have always been part of life. You have them in hunter-gatherer societies. But then through technological evolution, new forms of technology arise that facilitate or encourage the playing of non-zero-sum games involving more people over larger territory. Social structure adapts to accommodate this possibility and to harness this productive potential. So you get cities, you get all the non-zero-sum games, you don't think about them.
Non-zero-sum games are win-win games. Zero-sum games are win-loss games. I win, you lose. You win, I lose. Okay? Non-zero-sum games that don't add up to zero are games in which people either win together or lose together. The sum doesn't add up to zero. So what he's saying is we're seeing an increasing number of non-zero-sum games, of interactions between people which have the potential for win-win.
They're being played across the world. Like, have you ever thought, when you buy a car, how many people on how many different continents contributed to the manufacture of that car? Okay, those are people, in effect, you're playing a non-zero-sum game with. I mean, there are certainly plenty of them around. Now, this sounds like an intrinsically upbeat worldview in a way, because when you think of non-zero, you think win-win, that's good. Well, there are a few reasons that actually it's not intrinsically upbeat. First of all, it can accommodate, it doesn't deny the existence of inequality, exploitation, war. But there's a more fundamental reason that it's not intrinsically upbeat, because a non-zero-sum game, all it tells you for sure is that the fortunes will be correlated for better or worse. It doesn't necessarily predict a win-win outcome, okay? So in a way, the question is, on what grounds am I upbeat at all about history? And the answer is, first of all, on balance, I would say, people have played their games to more win-win outcomes than lose-lose outcomes. On balance, I think history is a net positive in the non-zero-sum game department. And a testament to this is the thing that most amazes me, most impresses me, and most uplifts me, which is that there is a moral dimension to history. There's a moral era. We have seen moral progress over time. 2,500 years ago, members of one Greek city-state considered members of another Greek city-state subhuman and treated them that way. And then this moral revolution arrived, and they decided that actually, no, Greeks are human beings. It's just the Persians who are not fully human and don't deserve to be treated very nicely. But this was progress. I mean, you know, give them credit. And now today we see more progress. I hope most people here would say that all people everywhere are human beings, deserve to be treated decently. And, you know, unless they do something horrendous, regardless of race or religion. And you have to read your ancient history to realize what a revolution that has been, okay? This was not a prevalent view a few thousand years ago. And I attribute it to this non-zero-sum dynamic, okay? I think that's the reason there is as much tolerance for nationalities, ethnicities, religions as there is today. You know, if you ask me, you know, why am I not in favor of bombing Japan? Well, I'm only half-joking when I say they built my car, okay? We have this non-zero-sum relationship. And I think that does lead to a kind of a tolerance to the extent that you realize that someone else's welfare is positively correlated with yours, you're more likely to cut them a break. I kind of think this is a kind of a business-class morality. Unfortunately, I don't fly transatlantic business class often enough to know, or any other kind of business class, really. But I assume in business class, you don't hear many expressions of, you know, bigotry about racial groups or ethnic groups, because the people who are flying transatlantic business class are doing business with all these people. They're making money off of all these people. And I really do think that in that sense, at least, capitalism has been a constructive force, and more fundamentally, it's non-zero-sumness that has been a constructive force in expanding people's realm of moral awareness. Okay, I think the non-zero-sum dynamic, which is not only economic by any means, it's not always commerce, but it has driven us to the verge of a moral truth, which is the fundamental equality of everyone. It has done that. As it has moved us toward the global level of social organization, it has driven us toward moral truth. I think that's wonderful. Now back to the unfolding apocalypse, okay? And you may wonder, okay, that's all fine, sounds great, moral direction of history, but what about this so-called clash of civilizations? Well, first of all, I would emphasize that it fits into the non-zero-sum framework, okay? If you look at the relationship between the so-called Muslim world and Western world, two terms I don't like, but can't really avoid in such a short span of time, they're efficient, if nothing else, it is non-zero-sum, okay? And by that I mean, if people in the Muslim world get more hateful, more resentful, less happy with their place in the world, it'll be bad for the West. If they get more happy, it'll be good for the West, okay? So that is a non-zero-sum dynamic. And I would say the non-zero-sum dynamic is only going to grow more intense over time because of technological trends. But in more intense in a kind of negative way, it's the downside correlation of their fortunes that will become more and more possible. And one reason is because of something I call the growing lethality of hatred. More and more, it's possible for grassroots hatred abroad to manifest itself in the form of organized violence on American soil. And that's pretty new. And I think it's probably going to get a lot worse, this capacity. Because of trends in information technology, in technologies that can be used for purposes of munitions, like biotechnology, and nanotechnology, we may be hearing more about that today. And there's something I worry about especially, which is that this dynamic will lead to a kind of a feedback cycle that puts us on a slippery slope. What I have in mind is terrorism happens here, we overreact to it, that you know, and we're not sufficiently surgical in our retaliation, leads to more hatred abroad, more terrorism, we overreact, because being human, we feel like retaliating, and it gets worse and worse and worse. You could call this the positive feedback of negative vibes, but I think in something so spooky, we really shouldn't have the word positive there at all, even in a technical sense. So let's call it the death spiral of negativity. I assure you, if it happens at the end, both the West and the Muslim world will have suffered. Okay. So, what do we do? Well, first of all, we do a lot more with arms control, the international regulation, dangerous technologies. I have a whole global governance sermon that I will spare you right now, because I don't think that's going to be enough anywhere, although it's essential. I think we're going to have a major round of moral progress in the world. I think you're just going to have to see less hatred among groups, less bigotry, and racial groups, religious groups, whatever. I've got to admit, I feel silly saying that. It sounds so kind of Pollyannish. I feel like Rodney King, saying, why can't we all just get along? But A, I just don't see any alternative. Given the way I read the situation, there's going to have to be moral progress, okay? There's going to have to be a lessening of the amount of hatred in the world, given how dangerous it's becoming. In my defense, I'd say, as naive as this may sound, it's ultimately grounded in cynicism, okay? That is to say, thank you. That is to say, remember, my whole view of morality is that it boils down to self-interest. It's when people's fortunes are correlated. It's when your welfare conduces to mine that I decide, oh yeah, I'm all in favor of your welfare. That's what's responsible for this growth of this moral progress so far. And I'm saying we, once again, have a correlation of fortunes, and if people respond to it intelligently, we will see the development of tolerance and so on, the norms that we need. We will see a further evolution of this kind of business class morality. So these two things, if they get people's attention, and drive home the positive correlation, and people do what's in their self-interest, which is further the moral evolution, then they could actually have a constructive effect, okay? And that's why I lump growing lethality of hatred and death spiral of negativity under the general rubric, reasons to be cheerful, okay? Doing the best I can, okay? I never call myself Mr. Uplift, okay? So just doing what I can here. Now, launching a moral revolution has got to be hard, right? I mean, what do you do? And I think the answer is a lot of different people are going to have to do a lot of different things. We all start with where we are. Speaking as an American who has children, whose security 10, 20, 30 years down the road I worry about, what I personally want to start out doing is figuring out why so many people around the world hate us, okay? I think that's a worthy research project myself. I also like it because it's an intrinsically kind of morally redeeming exercise, okay? Because to understand why somebody in a very different culture does something, somebody you're kind of viewing as alien, who's doing things you consider strange, in a culture you consider strange, to really understand why they do the things they do is a morally redeeming accomplishment. Because you've got to relate their experience to yours. To really understand it, you've got to say, oh, I did it. So when they feel resentful, it's kind of like the way I feel resentful when this happens, and for somewhat the same reasons. That's true understanding. And I think that is an expansion of your moral compass when you manage to do that. It's especially hard to do when people hate you, okay? Because you don't really, sometimes you don't want to completely understand why people hate you. I mean, you want to hear the reason, but you don't want to be able to relate to it. You don't want it to make sense, right? You don't want to say, well, yeah, you kind of understand how a human being in those circumstances would hate the country I live in. That's not a pleasant thing, but I think it's something that we're going to have to get used to it and work on. Okay. Now, I want to stress that to understand, there are people who don't like this whole business of understanding the grassroots, the root causes of things, the root causes of things. They don't want to know why people hate us. Okay. I want to understand that the reason you're trying to understand why they hate us is to get them to quit hating us. Okay. The idea, when you go through this moral exercise, of really coming to appreciate their humanity and better understand them, is part of an effort to get them to appreciate your humanity in the long run. I think it's the first step toward that. That's the long-term goal, okay? There are people who worry about this. In fact, I myself, apparently, was denounced on national TV a couple of nights ago because of an op-ed I had written. It was kind of along these lines, and the allegation was that I have, quote, affection for terrorists. Now, the good news is that the person who said it was Andy Goldberg. Okay. It's not a crazy concern, okay? Because understanding behavior can lead to a kind of empathy, and it can make it a little harder to deliver tough love and so on. But I think we're a lot farther, a lot closer to erring on the side of not comprehending the situation clearly enough than in comprehending it so clearly that we just can't, you know, get the army out to kill terrorists. So I'm not really worried about it, okay? So. I mean, since we're going to have to work on a lot of fronts, okay? But if we succeed, then once again, non-zero-sumness and a recognition of non-zero-sum dynamics will have forced us to a higher moral level, okay? And a kind of saving higher moral level, okay? It's something that kind of literally saved the world. If you look at the word salvation in the Bible, the Christian usage that we're familiar with, saving souls, that people go to heaven, that's actually a latecomer. The original meaning of the word salvation in the Bible is about saving the social system. Yahweh is our Savior, means He has saved the nation of Israel, which at the time was a pretty high-level social organization. Now social organization has reached the global level, and I guess if there's good news I can say, I'm bringing you. It's just that all the salvation of the world requires is the intelligent pursuit of self-interest in a disciplined and careful way. It's going to be hard. I say we give it a shot anyway because we've just come too far to screw it up now. Okay.
What if you could unplug your messy old chargers out and get a new charger for your things? One that's...
First, let's talk about this, and then we'll have a couple minutes to talk about the exercises. So, what do you want to say about this? What do you understand? What do you take issue with? What do you understand? Is there any discussion about what you just heard? Now, this is pretty, you might want to hear this one again. This is a very sophisticated talk. But what did you get from this, where are you with this? What do you need to know? Do you understand the basic argument?
Love thy neighbor.
Or at least understand thy neighbor and realize that thy neighbor and you are hooked into the same system. And if you throw your trash over there, it's probably going to negatively impact you also. Okay. Again, intelligent pursuit of self-interest. What else do you want to know or say? Okay, so Petalik.
I heard him, synopsis, that he took us through the caveman diocese.
The caveman diocese, yeah.
I know it's more than that.
Yeah, but, okay.
My husband's teaching it.
I think the caveman still exists in Isis, unfortunately. Okay, what? Anything else about this? Abraham. Loud.
I just wanted to mention that whatever we do, if it was a positive energy, we always get positive energy back. And if something negative is coming, we get the question, what negative are we doing? And, you know, we fail to do that. And the idea, like, you know, I'm expecting to be in a non-sum game of winners and winners, or loser and losers. Then I lose the perspective of our physical existence, which includes the negative and the positive. I have to acknowledge that there is positive and also as well as negative. And it's up to me which of the side of the equation I would behave like. So I just feel like, you know, it's a simpler than the discussion that is. Like my understanding, it just everything is So just accept it as is. So.
Well, what you said is how you act induces response.
Right.
So what he said is, if we're getting a negative response from other people, we have to ask, what part are we playing in provoking that response? And that's a morally redeeming but difficult thing to do. Other people, Carl.
Well, looking at it from the point of view of cell biology, the body can deploy an immune response to eliminate misbehaving cells or attack invading cells, but you have to be very careful and restrained at deploying that immune response, or it becomes totally self-destructive. And our cells and our bodies are generally engaging in non-zero-sum games. That's why we can think and walk around and do everything we do as complex organisms. That's a very good model, biological model of non-zero-sum economics.
Yeah, and what Carl said is, if your immune cells attack your own body, if they don't play a win-win game, but they become vengeful, then the whole organism goes down, or is lessened. Okay, so Robert.
I hate to be a wet blanket, but I really appreciate what he's saying. But there is one thing that's kind of discouraging, is that, when I was a kid, there was more material reasons why people in other parts of the world hated us, because we were oppressing them, overthrowing their governments, taking their resources, all this kind of thing. But when you look at organizations like ISIS, there's nothing idealistic there. It reminds me of the scene in James Bond movie where Bond has been captured, and he says to them, "Well, what do you want from me?" "Why, nothing, Mr. Bond. I just want you to die."
In general, what he's saying is rational people in various places will realize that their fortunes are correlated and will cooperate with one another. But not every person or group is rational. And that's why you have to have jails or places to, because not every, there are people that don't understand that they're creating a negativity for themselves when they do what they do. They're kind of out of control, and those people you have to deal with. So you can't walk around totally idealistic, because there are people that aren't at the level of understanding the consequences of their actions. Okay, I want to, Len, and then I want to ask you a question or two about your, maybe we'll have a time for that, about the my purpose exercise anyway. So Len.
Just to elaborate on what Carl said, part of what the immunological reaction in the body is really mirrored in society, when part of the problem is we're tribal and we're always seeing somebody from the other tribe as the enemy or not us, and therefore we can go after them because they're not really part of us, and that's exactly what happens in the biological immunological reaction. And so, somehow or other, we have to start recognizing that they are us, and not send out the troops to annihilate them just because they're different than us.
So that's what John Haidt said. He said, you have to acknowledge that there are the things that are built into us evolutionarily, and one of those things is in-group loyalty, and seeing the other group as a rivalrous. What Peter Singer, the great moral philosopher, said is moral progress across the generations consists in widening the circle of people whose interests you see as equivalent to your own. Right? Widening the circle of people whose interests you see as equivalent to your own. So what he said is, as we become more globally connected, and we see that the people over there are actually people, not demons, then we start to think about their welfare. So in that sense, what he's saying is globalization has been a good thing in that sense.
in that it connects people that formerly were looked at as other than or the out-group. Now they're seen as people that you Google and you Facebook and et cetera, et cetera. I just want to ask maybe one or two people, did anybody get anything out of that My Purpose exercise, writing a mission statement for your life? If you did, raise your hand. So not very many people. I think it's a great exercise and the hardest, because you're supposed to, in one sentence or phrase, or a couple of sentences, but one sentence ideally, supposed to say what it is that your life is about, what you want your life to stand for, why you're here. And that's a tremendously hard thing to contemplate and then to formulate. I've been working on it for 7.5 years, and I just got my best statement 2 weeks ago, which I'm not going to tell you, of course. The point is, that exercise, if you had one thing that could be chiseled in stone on your grave or above your door, what would it be? Carl Jung, by the way, did kind of that thing. Above his door at Kusnacht, which is his house where he saw clients, his big five-story house, he had called or not called. Spirit is here. So that's really where he was coming from. He was trying to make modern scientific psychology compatible with spirituality, which was, if you really look at his theory, that's really where it goes. So the point is, what would you chisel across the entrance to your door? And can you do that in a few words? That's a wonderful exercise, that exercise. As for the considerate driving exercise, you might want to sit. It might save somebody's life. You know, that's a really important exercise too. Abraham, you want to say, and then I want to say one last thing.
With due respect to Robert's scenario, I disagree. When we create a situation when we say to ourselves that somebody is killing us for no reason, we're actually given an excuse. So instead of like looking for a reason, we just say no, it can be answered.
Okay, so I think to put these two together, you look for a reason, you try to understand what they're objecting to. If they're sane, then they have some objection. They're probably doing, they're acting egregiously, but they're acting criminally, but they have a reason for doing what they're doing that you can understand. But there are some people that don't have a reason. Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower guy who shot all the people, he had a brain tumor. Okay, and he had no reason. It was that something was wrong with him. There are people that there's something wrong with.
Yeah, there is a reason. It has to be a reason.
Yeah, but you still have to deal with
the animal kingdom, for instance. The animal kingdom, the animals are behaving with a reason.
But you have to deal with them on the level it's effective. If an animal is enraged, then you can't let it run around. Okay, this is the kind of stuff we're going to keep considering when we come back to consciousness class, because it's all about consciousness. What I'm going to do now is end the class officially and then point you to right over there where the people who have artwork, stand by your artwork, and people can come and explain what it is. For example, Laura, explain what those things are, but I'm going to do that not at an official class. I'm going to do that right now at the end of class. Okay? And I'm going to put on a soundtrack, if I can do it, which I think I can, which Rich Winsler, the CD he just made, as part of the art thing. So we are adjourned until January. Go to the art fair. People who are getting CEUs, pick up your certificate and sign the sheet there, please. Okay? All right, we are adjourned.